This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week in news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us at 860-275-7266. As always, we're joined by Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Susan Bigelow. She's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there once again, Susan.
Good morning.
And Keith Vanniff is here. He's state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, our state budget guru. Hello, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
We are also on Facebook Live today. We've got all sorts of cameras in here, so you can actually experience this live on Facebook Live. It's going to be very exciting to watch. Let's start with an exciting news story coming out of the governor's race. We weren't sure we'd ever have any movement in this thing, no thinning of the field. But this week we hear Jonathan Harris announced that he is dropping out of the race and he's throwing his support behind Ned Lamont, who seems to be now the front runner.
I just sensed that my candidacy was going to be doing more to divide the Democratic Party and ultimately the state than to bring people back together at this critical time. And so it felt like the right decision to make at this point in time. And it was made a lot easier by getting to know Ned Lamont.
So that's Jonathan Harris dropping out and throwing his support behind Ned Lamont. Colin, is it fair to say now Ned Lamont is the pretty clear front runner in the Democratic race?
Yeah, no, I think that's more than fair to say, which is not to say that he has this nomination sewed up either. I mean, the question of Susan Bisewitz was always the biggest question for Ned Lamont. And now with Jonathan Harris getting out, and by the way, I mean, I think it is wonderful that he decided not to divide the party anymore, but I think the fact that his fundraising has stalled actually had a little bit more to do with that decision. And fundraising is going to be a problem for a lot of these candidates. Lamont is raising money the old-fashioned way. Bisewitz is theoretically going for the citizens' election program. I don't think that she's qualified so far, if she has qualified for that funding. You know, it's harder to do than people think. I always say to people now, okay, well, pick your favorite cause. Pick something you really believe in. All right, raise $250,000 for it in small amounts. How long is that going to take you? I mean, it's not that easy to do. So anyway, she may not have qualified yet. I think she probably hasn't. And she also may not have secured the unwavering support of 15% of the delegates of the coming convention. And that's critical for her. The Democrats would like to the extent there's any kind of Democratic organization at all, they would like to unify around Lamont. They would like to use the summer when the Republicans are going to have like five or six candidates warring out in this, you know, Game of Thrones scenario. They would like to use the summer just to sort of introduce Ned to the, you know, electorate and get people really comfortable with them. And to do that, they have to stay out of a primary. And to do that, they probably have to have a floor fight at the convention and see if they can keep Susan Bisewitz below 15%.
Susan?
Yep. It does seem like Democrats are settling on and settling for Ned Lamont. Ned Lamont is interesting in that he's both nostalgia and he for the 2006 Senate race. And he's sort of a what if for what might have happened if he had actually won that primary in 2010. But he's also coming into this as an outsider and a fresh face. So he can be many things to many people.
A shapeshifter.
Yes, he is a shapeshifter, a changeling. But yeah, I don't think that Democrats are really like on fire for him. But I think that he's like, all right, well, this is a decent choice. We can kind of go with this. That's great.
You, by the way, your young adult novel, Ned Lamont, Changeling, coming out in spring
of
next year. I think it's going to
be really good. Yeah.
And my softcore novel, On Fire for Ned Lamont, is also coming out.
Actually, isn't that a new sitcom on Fox?
Do you have anything to add to this, Keith?
I think they're bringing back Urkel for that one. I would be surprised if there's not a Democratic primary because in Ned Lamont, there will be some Democrats who have – even though I would agree he's probably the front runner right now, some Democrats would have pause at having another fiscal conservative leaning Democrat from Fairfield County. I'm not trying to say Ned Lamont is a clone of Daniel Malloy. But I mean, that's why I think we saw the mayor of Bridgeport this week say he's going to petition. Joe Ganim's going to petition if he has to get on a primary ballot. I would be surprised also just because the seat's been taken for 8 years now. if there wouldn't be some competition for the nomination in a primary.
Well, let's just talk through this, you know, fiscal conservative from Fairfield County piece of it, because, you know, Ned Lamont has gotten big support in this cycle from labor unions, and he's sort of positioning himself as someone who is on the progressive side of the Democratic Party.
Right.
Obviously something that you want to do at this point heading into a potential primary.
Okay.
But, I mean, is he really a fiscal conservative from Greenwich, or is he sort of this pro-labor guy who's an outsider?
Very fair question, and I think this is where Ned will be forced to show his colors. Despite the gobs of money that came in this month in the income tax that we'll talk about later, the state is still looking at sizable deficits after the election that are larger than the big bonanza of money that we just got. And we have a big problem going out over the next 10 to 15 years. And there is a significant portion of the Democratic Party that still wants him to answer this question. Mr. Lamont, do you believe the wealthiest citizens in Connecticut need to be paying a larger share of that bill? When he gives that answer, you'll get the answer to your question.
Mm. Colin?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, typically what candidates do is a Democrat will run a little bit to the left during the primary season and a little bit more towards the center in the general election. I think a Democrat's going to have a hard time winning the general election without some kind of fiscally conservative stance, without some kind of call for fiscal reform, probably pension reform. I mean, you look. We're going to be talking about the Eric Coleman situation a little bit later in the show. But I mean, it's an interesting symbol or stand-in for how people feel, fairly or unfairly, about the state system, and what they feel fairly or unfairly, and surplus, temporary surplus or no temporary surplus, is that it's a system that's out of control, and that it needs to be reined in. That there's economic dysfunction at the state capitol. So I think you have to run as some kind of reformer. And probably you have to run as a somewhat conservative fiscal reformer to win the general election. This is an election that the Republican Party could win on some of these fiscal issues if they don't nominate a sociopathic creep, which they have a tendency to do. This is a little bit like 4 years ago, where you sort of thought, wow, there's such widespread dissatisfaction with the Malloy administration and the way things are going. The Republicans can win this election. And they ran Tom Foley again, and that was that.
Well, I'm wondering, Susan, about this this idea of Joe Ganim, Susan Bicewicz, if those are the other options right now for the Democratic Party. Joe Ganim talking about petitioning onto the ballot. Of course, he can't qualify for the Citizens Election Program because of his, let's just say, checkered past. Mm. I mean, as he talked to Keith's colleague and our friend Mark Pasniokas, you know, Ganim's reminding party leaders of how the Democratic establishment supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 and turned their back on Bernie Sanders supporters. He told Paz, I don't want that to happen in Connecticut. I don't know, is there something to that, that this idea that the Democrats are coalescing around one relatively safe candidate who they know a little bit is actually going to cause them problems down the road?
When I think of Connecticut's Bernie Sanders, I definitely think of Joe Ganim first.
And then Susan Bicewicz.
Yeah, no kidding. Susan Bicewicz, total outsider. I don't think so. I think that's a real stretch. I think progressives and the Bernie Sanders crowd, they have no interest in Joe Ganim. They only have sort of a very mild interest in Susan Bicewicz. And they like Ned Lamont. So you're not going to see that sort of – this is a Hail Mary for him. He's trying to get attention, and he's trying to say, well, look, it's this Democratic establishment that's in the tank. It's all rigged. Great. But the alternatives are so bad that no one's going to get that excited about it.
Yeah, I don't know if I completely agree with Colin, and I'm not talking about the sociopathic creep remark. You have a Democratic Party that is not in the same place they were 8 years ago. People do know that a larger bill is coming. I look at the reaction that the Democratic Party had to the Fiscal Stability Commission's report. Their plan was centered on this idea of, okay, we have to drive down income taxes, even though 75% of the savings would go basically to millionaires, and we'll shift the burden onto the middle class through the sales tax, but that'll make Connecticut a haven for the rich. People didn't go into that. More people understand that a bill is coming, and I don't think a Democratic gubernatorial nominee, especially one as wealthy as Ned Lamont, is going to able to just say, I can reform pensions and we'll balance this massive budget hole with a silver bullet. People are going to be looking for more. Now, how many, I don't know, but a significant part of his party is going to want more.
Well, that's why I say the primary season is always a little bit different from the general election. But I also do think that, Keith, as usual, you're speaking with great knowledge and knowledge of great intricacies. The average voter, even in the Democratic primary and certainly in the general election, doesn't know anything about the Commission for Fiscal Stability or what their recommendations are or really how state government works or is funded. They don't have that kind of granular knowledge, and I don't think they vote on it. And typically, when people start campaigning, they start focus grouping and poll testing certain ideas. And I haven't seen those focus groups if they've happened. I haven't seen the poll testing. But my guess is that if you ask people, if you ask likely voters, do you think our fiscal house is in order? Do you think, you know, state compensation packages for state workers are out of control? I mean, I think you could predict some of these answers. And so the candidates have to ultimately craft some of their positions, not so much on the stuff that you know,
because right.
you know so much more than the average person, but on how people feel about this stuff.
Can I fire a quick follow-up question at you, though? I'm curious about this. Since the last recession ended over the last decade, it seems like for the most part, every 2 years our campaigns – state campaigns have been dominated by promises of silver bullets, and people keep getting let down. How many times have somebody said, okay, we've got our arms around this problem, and then I get to come out and report a new deficit and get more hate mail, and the cycle continues? At what point does the electorate start saying, I don't know if I'm ready to buy into another sounds too good to be true silver bullet answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's – you have to ask yourself –
without all that quote-unquote knowledge.
I want to hear what Susan has to say about this, but I mean, I think – what's the alternative? Agnosticism? Like, well, I got nothing, so.
Yeah, I think at this point, in 2010, the idea of taxing the rich as that silver bullet was a lot more attractive than it is now, especially because people feel like we've kind of tried that. It didn't work. We've tried all these other things, and they didn't work. And someone's going to have to get real. And, you know, people at this point are less blaming the rich. And a lot of that blame really has shifted onto the unions. People, that's when they badmouth state government, that's what they talk about. So a Democrat's going to have to try and figure out how to deal with that anger at state employees and state pensions without really just blowing up their relationship.
It'll be another silver bullet. Every existing public sector employee on the job today could storm the Capitol and demand you cancel their pension for the good of the state. And you still would be in – the overall problem would not shrink that much. There's no one solution. I wasn't saying taxing the ritual. No one solution will cover the whole bill, not even close.
Well, let's turn to the Republican side quickly before we have to take a break and figure out whether or not either the Republicans have any solutions or silver bullets, or even if they're coalescing in any way, shape, or form around a candidate. One of the things we found interesting, Colin, this week was that John McKinney, just a few years after asking Dave Walker to join him on a ticket for governor and lieutenant governor, he's now endorsed Tim Herbst to be governor of Connecticut, something that I guess sort of surprises us from the fairly mild-mannered McKinney, given the background of the, let's say, rather fiery Tim Herbst.
Right. And Tim Herbst, in addition to that, Tim Herbst has this week suffered the revelation, I think it was in Daily Ructions, that he had had a text threatening to put out a cigar in the eye of one of his opponents, Mark Loretti, in this race, which is not way out of character for Tim Herbst. I was really surprised by this. There's obviously some backstory that I don't know about this. McKinney struck me 4 years ago as the right nominee for the Republican Party because of particularly his strong stance on government ethics and just his overall demeanor. I mean, just to sort of backtrack for a second, one thing that Ned Lamont has going for him, that John McKinney had going for him, is the perception that he's a nice guy. And we've had 8 years of a governor who, whatever his virtues, cannot get along with people. He can't get along with his own party, and he can't get along with the Republicans, and he brings everybody into a room, and the only uniting factor is they all hate him. So, you know, the notion of maybe having a nice guy run, the idea that maybe Ned could get, you know, both parties in the room and seek some kind of agreement. Similarly, I think the Republicans should be looking in that direction for that kind of person. McKinney was that kind of guy. Herbst isn't. I can't imagine why John McKinney would be endorsing Tim Herbst. I mean, if somebody knows, tell me. It just doesn't really make any sense.
And the Republicans do have candidates who are kind of like that, John McKinney, at least the image of it. Aaron Stewart is getting no traction. and I'm not sure why. I feel like she's kind of gone nowhere. But she is that sort of nice, moderate, fairly successful mayor of a fairly large city in New Britain. And for whatever reason, she just seems to be out of a lot of the conversations around Republicans. And I say for whatever reason, but, you know, she's a young woman. Maybe that's not what the Republicans are looking for.
We have to take a break, Colin. I want to ask you a quick question, though. We just got a phone call from someone saying, why aren't you talking about my candidacy? Sean Connolly called us up. We didn't have quite time before the break to take the call. And it does beg a sort of a question here, is that when we get to this point where we have a lot of candidates and we say, well, there's so many candidates, we can't name them all on the Republican side. There's a few top candidates on the Democratic side, but there are other people who are running. Are we too easily dismissing people like Sean Connolly and others who are still in the race but maybe haven't gotten a whole lot of traction or haven't raised the same amount of money?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes. I mean, there are so many candidates. There have been so many candidates in this cycle. The Democratic herd has thinned out quite a bit. Sean Connolly's background is in Veterans Affairs, and he himself is a veteran. I've met him. He's a very nice, well-spoken guy. To some degree, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I'm going to do a few shows this cycle with some of the more marginalized candidates, but even more marginalized than Sean Connolly. He's the kind of candidate who doesn't get covered because it doesn't seem as though he can attract either the kind of popular support that he's going to need. It seems unlikely to me that he'll get his 15% at the convention. But then it's fair for him to ask, well, is this a kind of self-feeding cycle? Like, you guys don't take me all that seriously, and then I get told, well, you can't get 15% at the convention because nobody knows who you are. I would understand if Sean Connolly felt as though this was a game rigged up in a way that he can't win it.
The Republican convention is coming up very quickly, but coming up even more quickly than that, it's the end of the state legislative session. We're going to turn our focus to that when we come back from a break. We're talking with Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Susan Bigelow, who is a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, and Keith Faneth, the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We'll find out what's going on with the state budget coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Keith Faneth, state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's in your show today?
So many of our show ideas are driven by peculiar things that the president says. So around the time of the Parkland shooting, he said maybe it's time to bring back insane asylums. We decided to take a look at the history of insane asylums and what they were like when there were a lot of them, but also some modern ideas for thinking about the same question.
My goodness. So that's coming up today on the Colin McEnroe Show. Hope you can check that out. News you can use. Today we're on Facebook Live, as a matter of fact. You can watch us, and if you're not watching live right now, you can watch us later on Facebook where we're at WNPR Wheelhouse. So let's turn to the state budget and all the things going on around the Capitol right now. We will turn to Keith Faneth and read this from one of your stories. I like this idea, Keith, that House Speaker Joe Arisemowitz threatened Tuesday to rekindle negotiations with Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy and craft a budget without the GOP. This is funny, right? So we had years and years and years of Democrats running budgets without any GOP involvement. Now, of course, we've got a little bit more cooperation, and it's forced cooperation up at the state capitol. And now they're saying, you know what, maybe we'll go work with the governor again. What's going on here?
I think there's some posturing. I think that both sides have so slipped into campaign mode that even though we have extra money coming in, they're not really enjoying each other's company right now. So the speaker's saying, why aren't we talking about the budget? And the answer is because I don't like you. I'm oversimplifying. But basically people aren't getting along. And I don't mean any one person doesn't like the speaker. I mean the two parties right now don't get along.
They don't get along over substantive issues. They don't get along personally. They don't hang
well,
together after
work. Well, they've been sparring over the city of Hartford's bailout. This even goes back to the nomination of Andrew McDonald to be Chief Justice. I mean, I think it was a month and a half ago, Governor Malloy said, we all know what's going on. The grand coalition appears to be fraying. And he's referring to the fact that the two parties teamed up last fall, around in September, and by October had produced a budget. Now they're in campaign mode.
Okay, so they're in campaign mode. We talked about this a little earlier with Colin, this idea that, you know, maybe the average Connecticut voter isn't paying as close attention to the budget as we might. I don't know if it's overstating things a bit to say they're in campaign mode around the budget. I mean, how does that play out, Keith?
Let's put it this way. Yesterday, the Speaker of the House said, listen, if the Republicans don't start taking this serious, we'll go down to the governor. In other words, we'll see if we can freeze you out. I fully expect within the next day or two the Republicans to alter their last budget proposal to probably promise something sweet. Not necessarily something that's ever going to be delivered, but something sweet.
Okay. You mentioned something earlier about this new windfall we have. This is a brand new thing. Try to give us a sense of what kind of windfall we're talking about here. So we have better than expected tax receipts, which is the first time that's happened in a very, very long time. So what does it really mean?
You go back to the Great Recession in 2009, then you come into the first year out of it in 2010 and you start to recover. And then after that, basically every year we would get very minimal growth unless we raise taxes. And despite what people are saying, the tax increases did increase revenues, just not to the level people thought. They didn't decrease revenues. In other words, we haven't hit that Laffer curve downward point yet. That's gone on sort of in trudging slow motion for 8 years until this year. The problem is nonpartisan analysts, people actually on both sides of the aisle are warning most of the factors driving these numbers up appear to be one time. We have a law that Congress passed a decade ago that said basically gave the hedge funds a decade warning, but they had to repatriate money they've been amassing in offshore accounts back here, pay taxes on it. It's a one-time bump. That happened this time around. We also have a situation where people who had a lot of money from capital gains and dividends tried to make some larger payments than they normally would at the tail end of 2017 to take advantage of more favorable federal tax rules that were expiring. Long story, a little less long. After 8 or 9 years of finding out in April that we probably had to downgrade our revenue expectations for a $20 billion budget, this time around we found out there's about $1.9 billion more than we expected, $1.5 billion this year, and maybe $400 million of that will continue next year. So it's a big pot of cash, most of which is one time.
So then why, Keith, before I hear from other panelists, why, if there's this sudden bump, aren't people getting along? I mean, you would think in more flush times, it would be easier for people to say, okay, let's figure out a way to solve some of the problems that we've been talking about for such a long time.
Okay, I'll give you one good example. Again, going back to the campaign mode, the Republicans are basically insisting that the budget includes some provision to make sure that whatever special assistance we give to Hartford after 2019 is neutralized. Anything Hartford gets after that, say to help pay down their debt, a matching amount needs to be deducted from their school grants or their property tax relief grants. That is going to fracture the Democratic Party. Those types of things make it difficult for the two sides to sit down. Not impossible, just difficult to carve out a deal.
Susan, what are your thoughts on all this? So in good or better fiscal times, we also have an election year and we have closely divided House and Senate. And so we have this again, still gridlock.
We do. And really, the Republicans have no reason to get along with anybody right now because they feel like if they just kind of try to hold the line, if they try to play up the fact that the Democrats spend too much, blah, 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 then they have a good shot at winning. They have a good shot at taking over the House next year. And right now, if they move to get along and try to help do some things that might be fairly unpopular with Republican voters and moderates, then they have less of a shot than people who might remember that. Although, again, I don't know how long people's memories are for this sort of thing. So, no, it is politics, and it is an election year. This is not a good time for trying to get along, and I don't think Republicans are going to try to do it.
Ned Lamont said an interesting thing a couple of weeks ago. I guess that sounds like damning with faint praise. I didn't mean it that way. But he said something to the effect that if previous governors had done what Dan Malloy had done fiscally, the state would be in better shape. I think he was specifically talking about paying into the pension fund. And as Keith correctly points out, there is no silver bullet, no magic bullet, no single fix to all this. But it made me think a little bit about the fact that, like, I don't really understand why Dan Malloy has the lowest approval rating of any U.S. governor. I mean, I understand he's a porcupine and he's not, you know, the easiest guy to like. But in a way, I feel as though if you look – or if he got the blame for things that weren't under his control and that he couldn't really do that much about, maybe he should get the credit for things that are also that much – not that much under his control. I mean, right now, if I were the Democrats, I would be saying, you know, Dan Malloy took over in 2011 with a biennial, deficit of, what, $6 billion, something yes. like that. We're in – you know, we're putting money in the rainy day fund right now. He's a fiscal conservative. He's proposed lean budgets. He's proposed lean budgets that it took the two parties, either party, months and months and months to act on. I mean, they got in budget-making mode, as you pointed out, in October, which is not when you're supposed to get into budget-making mode, that, you know, that ultimately he's tried to exercise some real fiscal leadership here, and it's been fiscally conservative leadership.
Can I point out all the numbers in Colin's answer, and they were all accurate? That your nerd points are accumulating nicely, I just want to say.
Well, you know, the other thing I want to say is, you know, one thing that we don't talk about that much, and this is something where I think you and I agree, Keith, about that maybe something that Dan Malloy should be blamed for a little bit. When the Commission on Fiscal Stability and Doomsday, whatever it's called, when they put out their report, I think they said that if you cut all the exemptions out of the tax system, all of them, by magic, you get a $5.2 billion savings. That's how many exemptions there are in the system. And a lot of those exemptions, as the commission pointed out, are essentially corporate welfare or these inducements, you know, these things.
You're starting to lose a few points. The bulk of them are in the sales tax. That's not to say that there's no fat to trim or
right.
people No, the bulk of them are in the sales tax. Mm. And I mean, if you start messing with the sales tax exemption for groceries or prescription drugs, you're going to have a real problem. So there's something there. But it's that's almost tiptoeing into silver bullet territory.
All right. Susan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to say about Dan Malloy and his popularity. Colin was actually bringing up facts. And the voters don't care about that because they care about how they feel. And right now we've been in this very long era of bad feelings about Connecticut. And everybody's morale, everybody's sort of perception of the state and where we are is so, so, so low. And Dan Malloy's been tied to that. He was never really popular, ever. His approval rating started in the 40s and just went down from there. But the reason why he's so, so deeply unpopular has less to do with what he's done and more to do with how people feel about the state.
Yeah, just a quick add, because I think Susan just nailed it. Governor Malloy, Collins Wright, didn't create the problems. However, throughout his first term and even into the first year of the second term, the expectations he set forcefully in porcupine-like fashion were that he solved the problem. And that's where I think, in addition to the personality challenges, he runs into trouble because people kept thinking, okay, and it's not okay yet.
I want to turn to – we were talking about silver bullets before. We've been talking for quite some time about how we build back up the state's transportation fund. Of course, transportation funding has been a problem in the state for years. That special transportation fund constantly being raided. For years, many people have said, well, you could do tolls like the rest of the states in the Northeast. And everyone has said, no, 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 tolls are never going to come to Connecticut. Now it seems as though tolls might be coming to Connecticut and might be coming with some special goodies for Connecticut residents. Here's our friend Max Reese at NBC Connecticut. He got his hands on a document the DOT sent out to legislators regarding what the costs might be.
According to the document obtained by NBC Connecticut, Connecticut residents would receive a 30% discount on an Easy Pass, with bigger deals for commuters. Connecticut drivers would pay about 4 cents per mile normally and about 5 cents during peak periods.
Okay, Keith, let's break this apart a little bit. So there's a lot of different aspects to the toll bills that are out there. Before maybe we get to what Max is talking about there in discounts for Connecticut residents, how realistic is the idea that tolls are going to get pushed through soon?
Soon, not realistic. Eventually, yes.
Eventually, it's going to happen. But so where are we right now? Well, why not soon?
I think there is a very slim chance of tolls getting through the Senate. And there is a chance we could have a bill that I wouldn't call it establishes tolls. There is a bill the Speaker is close to getting the votes for to run in the House today that would require the DOT to develop a plan for tolls. Originally, the bill, which came out of transportation, said it comes back to the legislature next year, and if they don't act on it, it takes effect by default. They had to remove the default provision. So all it says is the DOT must prepare and present us with a plan. That's it. And if they never act on it, it stays in limbo. That's all we're talking about this session.
And to your political point earlier, Susan, I mean, this is something that probably a whole lot of legislators don't want to campaign around, given the fact that many people, when they hear tolls, they get very, very upset.
Yeah, and of course they do, because no one likes the idea of tolls. No one likes the idea of paying money for highways that they thought, at least, were formerly free. Of course, it does cost money to drive on any of the highways. The gas tax is part of that. Just, you know, paying for upkeep on the highways comes out of your tax money, no matter where you might spend it. It will come out of there. But so as for the discounts and things like that, though, this is actually the way that it works in a lot of different states. That, yeah, somebody, if you go, let's take Massachusetts for an example. I have a Massachusetts Easy Pass because you can buy them if you're a Connecticut resident. It doesn't matter. They'll send them to you. They'll take your money. And you get a little discount if you have a Massachusetts Easy Pass if you drive on the Mass Pike. I'm sure that's the same way that it would work here. People are also freaking out about the tolls because they feel like, all right, so if I have to drive to Stop and Shop, I'm going to get charged money. But that's not necessarily the way that it has to work, because this does not work like the way that that tolls are now. It doesn't work the same way that it did in the past, where you have you try to get on the turnpike, you take a ticket, you have to pay money every time you exit the highway. No, it doesn't work that way now. You get charged when you pass underneath a toll gantry. And that's how it works on the Mass Pike and on other highways around the nation. And you can be strategic about where you put those. So let's take, for example, Windsor, where there's a Stop and Shop and Target Plaza. And really the only good way to get there is to head from most of the town is to get on the highway and go north. You don't have to put a toll gantry between any exit in Windsor and that exit for the Stop and Shop. You can put one, say, at the Hartford Line and put another one at the airport, for example. So you can be smart about how you actually set these things up so that people who are using the highway for sort of incidental daily important things don't get charged as much as, say, commuters do.
And I'm sure that if Connecticut does this, they would do it that very smart way, and they wouldn't do it with any sort of political considerations.
Oh, no.
No, there wouldn't be any reasons why they were certain places as opposed to others.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a way in which Connecticut's a little bit like the Muslim world. You know, in the Muslim world in the Middle East, sometimes people will be talking about some huge, annoying or tragic grievance that's really, really bothering them. And after they've talked for a while, you realize that this is something that happened 1,100 years ago. And Connecticut's a little bit like that. People have incredibly long memories that they won't let go of. I was at a meeting last night where there was somebody who was relatively new to the state who was saying that, you know, he had heard about this terrible, terrible accident that had happened at a toll booth, and it took him a while to realize that this had happened decades and decades ago. But for people who live in Connecticut, the land of steady habits and the land of steady neuroses and grievances, it is the way that Susan described the first scenario in their brains. No matter what you tell them, this is going to be a terrible, terrible inconvenience. Now, the other part of this, like on the Hartford Current today, which I brought in on the front page, they've got, you know, a little breakdown of what you might pay going Hartford to New Haven, going Waterbury to Danbury. And I think when you see that written out, when people see that written out, even though it's not a lot of money, they're suddenly seeing amounts of money that they would be paying. And that's probably going to be a little bit of a problem. You know, I think in the abstract, the idea of tolls, which we experience exactly the way that Susan said, you're on the Mass Pike or you're going to New York, you don't hit a toll booth, you know, either you got the transponder or you get a bill because they just read your license plate or whatever, you know, and you don't really think about it too much. But when you see those amounts there, people are going to go, oh, I would be paying that amount.
In the amounts that are on here on the front page, you know, Hartford to New Haven, 38 miles, $1.33 off peak, $1.67 peak, Wallingford to New Haven, 44 cents, off peak, 53 on peak hours. So is Colin right, Keith? I mean, you just put real numbers to this. People all of a sudden don't like the idea of paying the $1.67 to drive to New Haven.
He is absolutely right. I'm giving him his nerd points back. But here's some numbers people don't see. And when they go, well, why is this going on? This is why it's going on. About close to 8 years ago when Governor Rell left office, and this may sound wonky, but it's significant, we had about $1.7 billion in transportation financing that existed only on paper. The legislature had approved it. The bond commission had approved it. But we hadn't actually borrowed the money. And it's not the treasurer's fault. She's not going to borrow the money until the DOT is ready to spend it. I don't want to borrow because I have to pay interest. But we can't start these projects because – we don't have enough money in the state budget to make the monthly payments on this borrowing. So we set it all up. We put out the press releases, but it doesn't happen. $1.7 billion in 2010 is $3.7 billion today. We have tons of projects that only exist in concept, that people think are going forward out there, that we can't ramp up. And when you think for every $1 of state financing we spend, it typically leverages $4 of federal matching federal funds, you can understand why the construction industry, labor and management is ticked off, because they're saying there's no way you can let this much back up and not have the viaduct, the mixmaster, and everything else fall into a state of disrepair.
Well, and again, historically, you spend or borrow state money and you leverage a certain amount from the federal government. Currently, it seems as though the federal government is looking to change that formula quite a bit so that there's even less coming in from the federal government.
And when you consider that we've been leeching money out of transportation, now the federal government wants to take more out, that's where the tolls are coming from. And unfortunately, those are numbers legislatures, plural, and governors, plural, have not been talking about probably for 20 years.
We have to take a break. I just want to say two quick things. One is on Keith's site on the Connecticut Mirror, in their viewpoint section, a really interesting piece by David McGuire from the ACLU talking about the potential civil liberties issues with these overhead gantries, taking pictures of your license plates, showing people where you are all the time. And just to your earlier point, Susan, about being strategic, instead of building a casino north of Hartford to try to keep people from going to Springfield, just put a whole bunch of gantries there. It'll cost way too much money to drive to Springfield anymore, right?
Oh, they'll just take Route 5.
Good, past somebody's house. We're talking with Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Keith Vanna from the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe from Connecticut Public Radio. We'll be right back with some more stories from the week's news right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We are talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio, Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror, and Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. A lot more to talk about here. I'm going to read from a Hartford Current editorial. Retired Democratic State Senator Eric Coleman turned 67 this month. He now earns an annual state pension of $21,824 for his years of part-time service in the legislature. Soon, as the Current's John Lender reports, that pension could jump to $110,000 because Coleman has hit the state capital jackpot. He's been nominated to the bench by Governor Daniel P. Malloy. You mentioned this earlier, Colin. The floor is yours. I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that I suppose lessens our confidence in the process.
Right. So the optics of this are horrible, and the substance of it is kind of horrible, too. This is the kind of thing they should have fixed. But what you basically have is, yeah, he's going to serve for 3 years, which is less than half of a judge's term. He will reap this tremendous pension benefit from it. And I think the way to think about it is not simply that it's more than $100,000 a year in pension. I think the way to think about it is that, you know, God willing, he'll live another 20 years. That's $2 million of money that's essentially our money. And I think this is the kind of thing that they should have fixed. And I think this is the kind of thing that can make it a very, very difficult political climate for the people who don't fix this. And whether it's this or, I mean, Keith, are there still longevity payments? Is somebody still getting longevity payments?
Yes. Yeah. Even though the last concessions deal in theory got rid of them, what we did was we just converted them into part of your base pay.
Right.
So they've been given a new name, but the money's still there.
And so longevity payments or longevity bonuses is money. It's a long-time thing that state employees have just gotten money, extra money on top of their salaries for because you hold up a mirror to their nose and they're still breathing.
The ones who had longevity pay when the concession deal came down, the new ones aren't getting it.
But you said earlier, Colin, you said, you know, they should have fixed this a long time. Well, they are they who benefit. I mean, why would we ever expect this to change?
Right. And here they're pretty clearly taking care of one of their friends, somebody they know pretty well. And yes. And well, look, if they, that it's one of the reasons that I'm a big believer in making as much of this kind of stuff the work of the legislature as opposed to the work of anybody else, because at least you can vote them out. One of the Republican arguments of late has been that all of these labor contracts should be voted on in the legislature as opposed to simply expressed through collective bargaining, because then you can vote against the people who voted for the labor contract that you don't like. I mean, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with that. I mean, if you look at how the legislature does stuff, it doesn't make you want to give them more stuff to do. I can't imagine why somebody wouldn't be furious about this. And if you're really mad about it, and you have a representative or a senator who voted for it, and they're not doing anything about it, get them out.
I mean, I completely agree with Colin. I do think that the legislature should vote on these things, much as they probably don't want to. But of course, this was actually written into the language that somebody who has state service, I believe is the language, can get that, can be brought into that $100,000 pension. You can get that for having a certain amount of state service. It seems like it was written with legislators becoming judges in mind. So they should fix it, the problem that they themselves created. Everyone who hears about this, they think it stinks.
Well, everyone thinks it stinks. And I mean, Keith, I guess I'll ask you, being our budget guru, when we talk about all these big numbers that the state has to dig out from under, I mean, how much of it has to do with this sort of stuff? The guy who is going to have a $20,000 pension now has a $100,000 pension and it adds up $2 million at a time.
Right. I don't know that it moves the big needle that much, but it moves the political needle huge. part of the problem is everybody has a skeleton in the closet. Sorry. Governor Malloy's DCF commissioner, Joette Katz, has a salary over $170,000 a year and a judicial pension over $100,000. And that wasn't a double-dipping issue in theory because, well, one is a judicial pension and an executive branch salary. But the fact of the matter is her compensation for the year exceeds $270,000.
And the judicial branch is a different state
altogether
that we're not paying for.
The administration was, this is my choice. That's the way it is. Deal with it. And I was just doing some quick checking. Don't forget, the legislature has not raised their own pay since 2001. The base pay was $28,000. Everybody's got some type of leadership title. Most of them are bringing home around $33,000. If you go back and do an inflation calculator, and because they're still making that now, that's like they were making $23,000 then. The point I'm getting at is that's then become the justification why these things are okay.
Aren't they adjourning pretty soon, the legislature?
Yes, they are.
So they're working about 5 months.
The point is you need somebody to come in and overhaul and look at this whole system, because what happens is that becomes the rationalization for why someone should get this pension, because they'll say, well, listen, the whole time they were a legislator, they didn't make enough. And it's just not a transparent system.
Mm. Yeah, and this is why the legislature needs to be full-time. And this is why the legislature needs to be well-paid. If they're part-time, like they are right now, then they can just not do things and things don't get done. They don't have to actually face problems. They can just let bills die if they want to. And if they're not well-paid, then only people who have the means can actually run, because, maybe you have a side business as a lawyer. Maybe you are, as some of them are, union negotiators or, whatever they might be. And they have gigantic conflicts of interest, or realtors. There's a lot of them who are real estate agents. And if you're not one of those things, if you have a regular job that you need income from, you can't run, because you can't say, well, during 5 or 6 months of the year, I'm going to be away at really bizarre hours. Sorry, you can't do that. And then you can't live off of that $30,000-whatever. It's just not enough. So only if you have the money to, or you live with your mom or whatever, can you actually manage to be a legislature. And that's not right.
Time to resurrect the McEnroe-LeBeau plan. McEnroe-LeBeau plan, unicameral legislature. There's no reason to have two chambers. And it screws things up. Go to CT News Junkie or CT Mirror right now. You're going to see a lot of articles about very worthy measures that have been passed by the House and they're going to die in the Senate, or passed by the Senate and they're going to die in the House. And these are things like, you know, domestic violence bills and stuff like that. Unicameral legislature, 75 of them. They make $75,000 a year. End of story. We have way more legislators than we need. We have one more chamber than we need. And Susan's right. Professionalize the whole thing so it's a real job, and then they can shut up.
McEnroe-LeBeau plan. We've talked about it before.
I can't believe I'm carrying Gary LeBeau on this all this time.
Look, we just have
no work on it.
We have a couple minutes left, and we wanted to talk about the Excel Center because the Capital Region Development Authority is issuing a, quote, request for proposals for the purchase of the aging Excel Center in hopes of attracting a buyer. Hold it. If it's aging and it's out of date, why would anyone want to buy this, Colin?
That's a mystery to me, actually. It's, you know, of course, in 1978, the roof fell in at the same facility.
That's such a long time ago.
And it looks as though maybe that could happen again. It really is. I mean, everybody agrees. It's in disrepair. I mean, in serious disrepair. You know, things don't work that really kind of have to work. I don't know what the right answer is. And my feeling is that I don't think a private entity is just going to come in there and buy it and run it. You know, I think it's going to be some kind of public-private partnership, and they're going to want some money up front from the state or the city or something, like fix this damn thing up. I will quickly say that this is an example, and I'm not saying anything bad about the people who are on the CRDA right now. The CRDA is basically the quasi-public entity that runs a lot of stuff in the greater Hartford area. But in general, and I'm not saying that this is their fault either, but in general, it's not a good way to do things. A lot of people are seeing the movie Little Pink House right now, which is about the NLDC and the Kelo case and what happens when you put a quasi-public in charge of things that elected representatives are supposed to be in charge of. We elect people to do these jobs. And you know, I was shocked when the Patricelli-Smith Doomsday Commission said that the CRDA was a great model for how to do stuff in the rest of the state. No, it's not. It and its predecessor, CEDA, these quasi-publics, they don't do a good job. They don't develop well. They're, you know, in some ways, the worst of both worlds, the private and the public sector. And I just wanted to sort of make that little speech right now. In terms of the Excel Center, I know that Suzanne Hopgood and all those people, they're trying really hard to figure out what to do about this thing, but it's a white elephant.
You know, and they've actually said that there probably would be some sort of state involvement. It's almost as if the state is trying to pay people to take the Excel Center off of their hands a little bit. And I'll give them $5 for it, and then I'll just dynamite the thing. I mean, at this point, I'm not sure that it really is worth saving the building. I'm not sure what you could do with it that you couldn't just put the money into building something that's actually right for the city. So, you know, good luck to them. I'm sure that they'll find someone who will do something, but it's going to end up costing the state, I'm sure.
Here's the problem they're facing. You won't find this in the McEnroe plan. One, the state has a debt limit tied to its revenues. And even with the growth, the new Hartford bailout deal and the assistance pushes the state over a key emergency warning threshold. Long story short, we have to start cutting borrowing in other areas. People are resentful at Hartford for that. And now the Excel Center improvements would be financed with borrowing. A lot of bad factors are coming together at once for Hartford. I would not be surprised to see some people say we should be pulling back on helping the Excel Center until this other Hartford mess is cleared up.
Yeah, but then what happens? So you got a building that's sort of rotting in the middle of the capital city, and you still want to be able to bring in people to have concerts or hockey games or whatever.
Right.
I mean, what do you do about that?
And when you've told a bunch of other legislators they can't come home and announce borrowing for a gazebo or a soccer field or streetlights in an election year, they don't care.
Colin?
It works pretty well for the sports stuff that it does. You know, I mean, it's in disrepair, and it's not going to be able to do those things if it doesn't fix them. But I think if you dynamite it. It first of all, it cost $40 million just to get rid of the building.
True. A lot of dynamite.
But without some kind of other plan for the city, just, you know, blow out that whole central part. I mean, it hasn't really been a functioning facility in a long time. It used to have like a lot of retail and restaurants and stuff like that in it. Hasn't been like that for a long time. I would agree it's not working, but you need to substitute some other plan or you're going to have an even sicker and more dying capital city on your hands.
And that's true. We need to have something that's actually right for the city there. And I don't think anyone's thought about that. I actually think we need a smaller arena, but that's just my opinion.
I suggested this a while ago.
Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you so much, Susan.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to Keith Faniff, our state budget reporter from the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. The technical producer is Kyone Wolf. Lydia Brown helped out with today's show. Carlos Mejia and Tucker Ives are the ones to thank for us being live on Facebook, or you can blame them, I suppose. We'll be back next week with The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio.